I did not announce myself as a newcomer, as a visitor, because I sobered up here at Club 12. So this is still home. It's wonderful to be here. It is always a privilege and an honor to be asked to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Roger. This is very surreal for me because I've moved a couple of times in sobriety, and it's always wonderful to come back here to my home at Club 12. My sobriety date is January the 15th of 1990, which I am forever grateful for. I have a home group. My home group is the Spirit of Freedom! In Manoa Valley on the island of Oahu in Hawaii. I actually have three sponsors. I have a sponsor in Hawaii. His name is Tony Apolado. I have a sponsor in California, where I lived for 15 years. His name is Tom Carney. And of course, I have a sponsor here in San Antonio, Roger Diaz. And I am a sponsor. I have three guys I'm actively working with in Hawaii. I've got a couple of guys in California still that I talk to regularly, and several other people around the country. So I am responsible. So where to begin all of this? This has been a really interesting year, and I'll get to a lot of that later, but let me go back to the beginning. So I was born in Glasgow, Scotland. My father's people are from the Outer Hebrides on the northwest coast of Scotland, where they distill the best whiskey in the world. Uh-huh. My mother's people are from Northern Ireland, where they've been fighting over religion for over 200 years. So I had two strikes against me before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But as far back as I can remember, I had this thing going on, and I can't really describe it. It's what, you know, we all talk about feeling different. I thought there were a lot of reasons on the outside why I felt different and didn't fit in. Kind of come to understand that I just had this fear. I don't know. I had fear of a lot of different things. I remember before kindergarten, I remember being fearful of even going to kindergarten, that I could even do anything. And that I've come to understand later that that's one of the big reasons why I drank. Is because I could not face that fear. Everything on the outside, I had fear about. Alcohol, as from what I've just told you, you can imagine alcohol is a huge part of the culture. I am the only person in my family that is in recovery. And the disease is rampant on both sides. And there's been a lot of death as a result of this disease. You know, we see that. You stay around for long enough, you see people die. My grandparents in Northern Ireland owned a pub, and in Ireland the family that owned the pubs live above the pub. And this pub had been in the family for about five generations, and nobody ever talks about it. But my grandfather lost it, and it's pretty clear why he lost it. I mean, he pretty much drank up everything, and they were essentially thrown out on the street. My grandparents moved to Glasgow, Scotland, because that's the place where, it's a big industrial center. That's where I was born, and we immigrated here to Texas when I was a wee laddie. I've lost it all. My father sounds like he woke off the boat yesterday. But I've pretty much lost it all. So, yeah, as I was saying, it's very much part of the culture. The first time that I got drunk, I was in Vancouver, Canada. All my aunts and uncles, they moved to Canada. We were the only, my immediate family is the only one that came to the States. So we went to Canada quite a bit. The first time I got drunk, I was in my cousin's basement. My cousin was having a party, and I found the answer. I found the answer to this fear problem that I was talking about that we had. And man, I'm telling you, it was the answer for a long time. I could talk to the girls, I was the guy at that time. because I had found the answer. And it worked, but it was that thing that we talked about. It was fun. It was fun with problems, and then it was just a hell of a lot of problems. But I am convinced, without a doubt, that I was an alcoholic from the word go. That very time that I drank for the first time, I climbed up on a ladder, and either I jumped off or fell off from the second-story window. I was a blackout drinker from the beginning, in other words. And the difference is that the next morning, my cousins and we were all sitting around, and my cousins, we were all holding our heads, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And they were all saying, oh my God, I'll never do that again. And I'm saying, oh my God, when are we going to do this again? And that was the difference. I was a pretty decent kid before that, pretty good grades and so forth, and everything changed after that point. If I was not drinking, I was trying to find ways to drink. Everything at my school, everything just went downhill. To make a long story short, by the time I was 18, I was drinking every day. I remember telling myself when I was 18, I was an alcoholic. Doing something about it is a different story altogether. My brother used to call me Dr. Destructo. Because I found out later, you know, doing the first step, you know, all the unmanageability in my life, alcohol was related every single time. Every single time. And I did. I did all kinds of crazy stuff. We do. You know, all the stuff that we do, I do. I could never finish anything that I started. I somehow scraped my way out of high school. I tried to go to college. I went to Texas A&M University for a few months. I went to San Antonio College for a few months. I went to Southwest Texas State University for a few months. No, I went for a few years. But I got sober. I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 27, almost 28 years old of age, and I had just—I was barely able to put together 60 hours of college. Now, both of my parents are very high overachievers. They have been very successful in their own chosen field, and my siblings as well. And so it was all this feeling about less than so much, you know, when I was growing up, you know, shortly before I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was married at the time, and it was a marriage that probably never should have happened. And I was trying to desperately save a marriage which was doomed from before it even got started. And you know, we've made our amends as far as that's concerned. But the place that alcohol took me, I would do this geographic thing where I would live here in San Antonio. I would work at different jobs and so forth. I never could get anything, you know, any long-term plan. And things would get too hot here, and I would go out, and I'd live out in the hill country out here, up by Blanco Canyon. I am such a, you know, we talk about being chameleons. I am such a chameleon, you know. I would drive up to 281 going out to the country here. By the time I got to, you know, about Lake of the Hills up there and across the county line, you know, I started talking a lot slower. And, you know, I was one of the boys by the time I got up there, I tell you.
Wow.
And the reason for that is because I wanted you guys to like me. I would do anything to get you guys to like me. But anyway, I would go up there, and I would work, and we would, you know, you can still run tabs in all the little bars up there in town. And I would, I'd live up there, and I'd build barbed wire fence out of the ranches, because I could drink and do whatever I wanted all day long. Things would get a little too hot out there, and I'd come back here to San Antonio and do something else here, and I'd kind of go back and forth on these mini geographics. I mean, that's just kind of what I did, and I'd go AWOL. I'd absolutely go over MIA, is more like it. And the place where it took me in the end, up in the town of Blanco up here, there's on the town square, there was this little, maybe some of you remember, an old grocery store there called Po' Boys on the town square. And behind Po' Boys, underneath it, there was this little door in the back. And there was a bar there called the Mole Hole. That was my hangout, and it got to the point where the bartender in the mole hole used to beg me not to drive home every night. He begged me to not drive home. And I was living in a place out about 10 miles outside of town in this little wooden shack with a concrete floor, about 100 square feet and no bathroom. And that's where alcohol took me. And I swore that I was going to lock myself up in this place. I was not going to smoke and I was not going to drink, which lasted about a day. But, you know, there was jails and so forth. There was jail here, Bexar County Jail here in San Antonio. There was jail in several other locales around San Antonio. And, you know, I got several what we call moments of clarity. Like staring down the wrong side of a 12-gauge and a 12-gauge shotgun and a 30-06 in the middle of the night. I was in jail, this is in December of 1989, I was in jail in Comal County in New Braunfels, and I had nobody to call. My father had told me sometime before that, he said, "You're a liar, you're a thief, and you're a bum." He was right. Interestingly enough, about 6 or 7 years ago, my sister and I the executors of his will. And that's the contrast between then and now. So anyway, there was nobody to call, and I was there in public intoxication, and I asked the guard there. Oh, the funny story about this is, you know, they're obviously much more serious about DWIs nowadays than they were then. I was driving up 281, and I pulled over to the side of the road, and I went to sleep in the car. And at that time, I had an Australian Blue Heeler. These are great dogs, but the thing is, they're very, very territorial. I had the dog in the car with me. And I passed out, and I was on the side of the road, and the engine was running. And the next thing I knew, I wake up, and the police officer's opening the car, trying to undo the seatbelt, and the dog attacks him. So both the dog and I went to jail that night. I was in one cell, and he was in the other side of me. So anyway, here I was in Comal County, and I remember asking the guard, I said, if I just serve out my time, when can I get out of here? And he says, "You can get out of here on Christmas Eve." And I had absolutely no idea when that was. But turned out, I found out later, this was on the 22nd of December, 1989. And I had no idea when Christmas was. So anyway, make a long story short, I had, a number of more moments of clarity. And something happened to me on the 14th of January of 1990. And I cannot explain to you what this is, but I knew in the very fiber of my being that I was done, that I could not go on the way that I was going. I hear people talking about, they cried out, "God, please help me." That's not part of my story. Because God was in this other place way over here long ago. But I just knew in the very fiber of my being that if I did not do something about this, I was going to die. And I knew that I would not make it to 30. So I called some friends of mine who live here in San Antonio, and they're in the mental health industry, and they called the central office for me here in San Antonio. Before I knew it, within about 20 minutes, there's this knock on the door. I opened the door, and there's this big burly, I can't remember who this guy was, this big burly guy with his big beard. He goes, "Come on, I'm taking you to a meeting." So off we went in his truck, and we came here to Club 12. And at that time, there was this little room over here in the back. It was a little filled with smoke over here.
I remember that.
Walk in, and I don't remember very much of what was said in that meeting. But I remember thinking, how does sitting in a meeting with all this smoke and all these people going to keep me from drinking? Because I got all these problems, don't you know? But I do remember what they did say, "Keep coming back." They said, "Come back tomorrow and don't drink in between meetings." And I did that. I came back the next day. And I walked in here, and for the longest time, I had this excuse. The last excuse left, I'm too young to be an alcoholic. And I walked into this room, and there was a table, one of the long tables right here, and there's this fellow sitting at the table here. And he was 19 years old and he had 3 years of sobriety. So the last excuse was gone. And we sat down and he said, tell me, what's going on? Oh, my life, I can't, it's horrible, you know, I'm an alcoholic, I know I'm an alcoholic, I can never drink again, blah, 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 blah. He says, wait, hold on just a minute. He says, do you think you could make it for the rest of the day without drinking? What does that have to do with anything? I can't drink for the rest of my life. He said, no, do you think you can make it for the rest of the day without drinking? I said, yeah. You know, we hear, I've heard many times over and over again, any idiot can stay sober for one day, right? And I said, yeah, I think so. He goes, that's all you got to worry about right now. And it was my first introduction to this concept that we have about one day at a time.
That's awesome.
Got to keep it that simple. I've got to look at life one day at a time. And I kept coming to meetings here at Club 12. And what I did was what most of us do. I compared my insides with all you guys' outsides. I felt absolutely horrible. I felt my life, all of this, blah, blah, blah. And I felt horrible, et cetera, et cetera. And I saw all you guys laughing and joking and having a good time. I thought, how can this be? Because I thought that it would never change. Suddenly, I started to realize, wait a minute, there's more to this than just not drinking. Suddenly, I started to believe that there's this life, you know, that we have here, that we talk about, this design for living, where you can be happy, joyous, and free.
This guy's really interesting.
And I started to think, maybe, just maybe this thing will work. The longest I stayed sober on my own power before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was 2 weeks. 2 weeks. So anyway, I started to get this inkling of hope. After about a couple of weeks, a big burly cowboy, I mean, we kind of wasn't my first choice probably for a sponsor, so I started looking around, and there was this meeting in that little room back there on Saturday night. And the topic of the meeting was positive attitudes. It was on 9:30 on Saturday night. And let me tell you, did I need a positive attitude at 9:30 on Saturday night? And there was this gentleman who was chairing this meeting with this big smile on his face, and he was happy. I thought, man, that's what I want. This fellow's name was Roger Diaz.
Oh, wow.
So after the meeting, I swallow my pride, and I go up to him, and I say, will you be my sponsor? And he looked at me. He says, oh, are you new around here? I said, no, 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 I've been coming here for 2 weeks. And he smiled. And then he got very serious, and he said, are you willing to go to any lengths? And I was absolutely willing to go to anything because at that time I was desperate. I was in pain. I was absolutely desperate. So he and I started on this journey in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first thing that he had me do, he had me sit down and he had me write and write and write and write and write on the first step. And that was very, very important for me. By the way, it's my opinion that, especially in the beginning, sponsorship is absolutely, it is so important. It is true in my own experience. I have seen it working with other people. Because I was what the book talks about, that the alcoholic is unable to differentiate the truth from the false. That was me when I walked in. And I needed somebody to help me walk through and sort all this nonsense out. I cannot do this on my own. So anyway, I wrote, and I had all this stuff that I had totally forgotten about. I had forgotten that by this time, when I was 28 years old, that I had 18 car accidents. I'd never had a DWI. I'd always been able to walk and talk and walk the line and do all that stuff. You know, there's one of the stories in the back, and it talks about that person was always seemingly the least drunk person in the room, and suddenly they were wildly out of control. That was exactly me. That was exactly the way that I was. So anyway, through all that unmanageability that I wrote and wrote and wrote about, every single one of those things, alcohol was related, if not the cause. So through all that unmanageability, it was absolutely clear to me just how powerless I was over alcohol. I really didn't have that much problem with the first step because I was in that much pain. Now came the difficult part. The difficult part was, okay, yeah, I understand that I'm an alcoholic. The difficult part was, okay, here's the solution. It's a spiritual solution. And the first time that I walked into these rooms and I saw all this stuff in the wall, I said, yeah, no problem. Yeah, no problem. Yeah, wait a minute. No. This is not going to work. And he sat down and he said, open your book. And you know what? We opened the book to We Agnostics. And I can't remember what page it's on. There's a line in We Agnostics and it says, if a man does believe or is even willing to believe in a power greater than himself, then we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. Close your book. That's all you need to worry about. And it goes on to say that that is the simple beginning that we have. And a wonderful spiritual experience can be built upon that. And that was exactly what I needed at exactly that time. Simple. I have to keep it simple. Because this thing, I'm a smart guy, don't you know? I can complicate the hell out of anything. So then we looked at the third step. And the third step, as he explained it to me, this is simply a decision. That's all it is. It's a milestone in your life. Before, you tried to do it this way. It didn't work. Now, you're going to do it this way. Make the decision to do that. I have to reaffirm that decision all the time. I have to reaffirm that decision every day. Because my sobriety is a contingent upon the daily maintenance of my spiritual condition. And there are many times when I pulled it back and I said, no, I can't do this. And the 12 of 12 talks about that. That I slammed the door shut. And I need to keep going after that, fake it till I make it, and it comes back again. The door of willingness opens again. I put the key in. The fourth and the fifth step. What freedom there is in the fourth and the fifth step. For me, it simply boils down, this is my opinion, of course. For me, it simply boils down to this. There is such freedom in this step because everything that I thought was so terrible and horrible boils down to two things. Either I had some part in it to play, to set the ball in motion, or there are people out there that I need to be compassionate about, or toward. Everything falls into those two categories. And that, you know, there's wonderful freedom. Because before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I could never get past the second call. Oh, yeah, it's your fault. Oh, yeah, I did this, but no, you. Oh, I did that part, but no, you're to blame. And I got such freedom from the fourth and fifth step. Of course, you know, it was not the monster that I, sharing the fifth step that I thought it was going to be. And Roger heard so much stuff before that this was like, Six and seven are about humility. And this is the part that I cannot do on my own. You know, if I could generate some kind of humility on my own, what would I need Alcoholics Anonymous for? I could, you know, be humble and then everything would be fine. But my humility has to come through whatever action that I'm taking. It's all about action. Eight and nine is about making things right with the world. There's a lot of stuff. Like it talks about, those three categories that I had to go out and do the amends right away. I had to swallow my pride and go to it. There's other stuff, the other category in which, well, when the time is right and God puts this person in my path, and it did happen that way, then I'll make the amend. And there are some amends that, even to this day, I know I cannot make. But that's okay, because I was willing to do so. Step 10, I'm not really good at this. I try at this, but I'm not really good at it. I'm getting better as time goes on. And that's what the book talks about. It talks about progress, not perfection. Thank God for the 10th step, because when I do screw up, I can go back and fix it. thank God for the 10th step. Step 11, the only thing that it asked me to do is seek. First word of step 11, sought. That's all I have to do. Now, what I have to seek for is God, is my understanding of what God's will is. This all comes to the wonderful culmination of these steps. Step 12. I have, having had a spiritual awakening, the high point of my life is sponsoring guys, is sitting down with another man, showing them what I did, what was shown to me. And the difference is that before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, so many people said to me, Neil, what the hell is wrong with you? You should do this. You should do that. Why don't you do this? When I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous, this gentleman said, this is what I did. That's all he said. He laid this spiritual kit of tools at my feet. And it is a privilege and an honor for me to do the same thing with new guys that come in. It is wonderful to be a part, to see that light go on. And the other interesting thing about it is that so many times when, you know, I'm sitting down and I'm talking to another man, and the words that are coming out of my mouth are exactly the words that I need to hear at that moment in time. Interesting how that happens. This is a wonderful program. Like I said, 2 years ago, my wife and kids, we all moved to Hawaii. This was a good move for us. My wife is from Japan. So it's close to her family. I get back here quite a bit. I have a wonderful ability to make a living that was given to me by the grace of this program. It's really interesting. Roger and I were talking, I think it was your birthday, your 50th birthday, a year and a half ago. And I was thinking back when I had a year sober. And when I had a year sober, I had the answer. I went to Roger and I said, Roger, I know the answer to all my problems. What I'm going to do is I'm going to buy this hot dog truck. And I'm going to take this hot dog truck to Northeast Preserves out there on Saturday morning and sell hot dogs to the soccer families out there. And all my problems will be solved. Well, thank God that God did not give me what I thought I wanted. Because the path that he had for me is so much better than what I thought I wanted when I had 1 year sober. So, that's the thing. I need to stop trying to figure all this stuff out. So, 2 years ago, we moved to Hawaii. For the previous 15 years before that, we lived in California in Silicon Valley. So I moved here when I was 7 from San Antonio in 1997 when I had 7 years of sobriety. And you know, we hear about it all the time, life on life's terms. There is going to be adversity. There's going to be adversity. But this is the thing that, you know, the wonderful tools that we have, and when we have this adversity, we can walk through all that stuff. In 97, when I moved to California, all the old-timers told me, Neil, when you move, treat yourself like a newcomer. Find a home group. Plant yourself in a home group. And I didn't do it. Because all those people in California, they just didn't do AA right. Not like here in Club 12. So what I did was I cherry-picked meetings. I went to meetings here and there and so forth. And after a while, I went to less and less and less meetings. And I went on a little dry spell for a while. And it was miserable. It was absolutely miserable. Thank God I did not drink. After a period of time, I came back and I planted myself in a meeting and in a home group. And I got a sponsor and did all that stuff. But the what came out of that experience, a couple of things came out of it. One, it taught me very clearly that, or it showed me very clearly that the disease of alcoholism resides right here. Not drinking, but absolutely crazy. And it also showed me what, you know, the importance of the fellowship of this program. You know, one of the other things that came along is my, the other wonderful thing is I have a wonderful family. I have four sons. All four of those were born to me in sobriety. My eldest son will be 23 in August, and my youngest will be 11 in July. So between 23 and 11, none of them have seen their father drink. One thing that happened, my third son is autistic. And when we discovered that he was, we went through a lot of denial at first. It was a big struggle. And when I found out that, when I started to deal with this, I was mad. I was really mad at God, and I was saying, God, why are you doing this to me? Don't you know I'm working the steps? I sponsor people. This is my, the program is the center part of my life. Why? I was sitting in a meeting one day, and I was listening to a lady that I know share. This lady has had, at that time, terminal cancer. She asked the same question. And the answer that came back to her that she shared that day was, why not you? And I understood. And then I understood that this boy, this wonderful, silly boy, thinks very differently than the rest of us, was put in our life as a gift. My wife and I are entrusted with the life, with showing this young boy through life. And he is so funny. This boy teaches me about honesty. He teaches me about purity. On my 50th birthday a few years ago, they had this whole thing planned for my birthday. And all the kids came in the morning, happy birthday, Daddy, happy birthday, blah, 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 blah. It's like, oh, wonderful. And Ian, my artistic son, he comes up to me, he goes, Daddy, who are you going to invite to your surprise party tonight?
Uh-oh.
And it made me cry. His honesty and purity, and he teaches me that on a regular basis. So, this year has been a very interesting year. One of the other things that I need to talk a little bit about is that my work takes me, I travel a lot for my work. This has been sort of a good thing and a bad thing recently, but I'll get into that in a minute. And an old timer once told me, look, when you travel, you need to go to meetings. It's really important. You'll see a lot of stuff. I said, yeah, I understand. And I didn't for a while. And then on this one particular trip, I was in Bangalore, India. And it was not a good trip. And the business was not going well. And the thought came back to my mind, maybe you should go to a meeting. And the first thought after that is like, I'm on the other side of the planet. There's not going to be, in India, there's not going to be a meeting here. But then I swallowed my pride and I looked on the internet. And sure enough, there was a meeting with 5 minutes walking distance from my hotel. So I get up and I walk around the corner and I walk into this room and there's about 30 people in this room and this meeting was being conducted in English, in Hindi, and in Telugu, local dialect. It was being conducted in three different languages. And I understood exactly what was going on throughout the whole meeting. Why? Because it is what we talk about, the language of the heart. One alcoholic is suffering, I feel it. You feel it. When I get up here and talk, I can go and talk to people out there all day long and they'll understand up here on this level. But when I get up here and I talk what's going on here, you guys feel it. You guys know what I'm talking about. And since then, I have gone to meetings whenever I can. I have a home group, a home away from home group, which I haven't been to in a while, in the city of Cork, in County Cork, Ireland, it's fun. Let me tell you something. The guys in Cork, they say, I tell you, we know the program works. Because if it doesn't work here in Ireland, it'll work anywhere. And some of them, you know, that with that Irish wit, they say, you know, you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you stay here a while. You don't get older, you just get cuter. And And you know, that is what I need. I need that laughter. I need to laugh at myself. I need to laugh with you guys. That's what this thing is all about, being happy, joyous, and free. One of the other places that I go to quite often is Taiwan. And the interesting thing about that place is that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not very old. It's only about 20 years. It's only been in Taiwan about 20 years. And let me tell you, it's really interesting to hear people talk in this day and age. And they talk about that in their lifetime, they did not have this wonderful option that we have. That in their lifetime, if you're an alcoholic, the options were jail or the asylum, period. To hear it like the people who started this program, the way that they lived it. So it really changes your perspective. I have had such wonderful opportunities to be of service. During the convention in 2010 here in San Antonio, which was, again, another surreal experience for me because I saw all you guys being of service at the convention. And, you know, a year or so before I came up, I was living in California at the time, and I was telling my California sponsor, oh, it's going to be in San Antonio, and it's great. You know, I know this place, and I know that place. And he goes, you're the tour guide. I said, okay. And so I took about 15 people from California and brought them to all kinds of different places here in San Antonio during the convention. It was they talk about, tour, taking alcoholics on tours like herding cats. And it was, but it was a wonderful, experience. And so one of the other things was, I don't know if some of you may have seen during the convention, there was a play that was going on. It was called In Our Own Words. And it was written by a playwright in San Francisco. And the year after that, they did the production. They did one production again in San Francisco, and they did another one in San Jose, where I was living. And I had the opportunity of being part of that production. I had two roles in the play. The first role that I had was Reverend Sam Shoemaker. And then the second role was a gentleman by the name of Barry Leach. I don't know if you guys, some of you may know who Barry Leach was. He was the one who wrote Living Sober. But in addition to that, he was also the first openly gay man in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got to play this role. And it was absolutely, it was really incredible because the monologue and what it talked about as far as this character is concerned is the third tradition. The development of the third tradition back then, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. That all the other stuff, whatever we are, wherever we come from, all of that stuff does not matter. Does not matter. Desire to stop drinking is the only requirement for membership. And, who am I to judge anybody? Who am I? An alcoholic who has been given the grace that I have been given. Her grace defined as unmerited favor. Who am I to judge anybody? So this was a wonderful experience. It was sold out every night. They extended the show. Almost everybody in the cast was in the program, and there was not a dry eye in the house. There was not a dry eye in the backstage with everybody who was in it. And there were two women who were two actresses who were in it that were not in the program. And I was talking to one of them. I said, I asked her about her opinion, what she saw, and so forth. And she said that she was absolutely amazed at the love. The love that we have for each other, the fellowship. And I can tell you from my own experience that is the same thing. Somebody once told me that when you come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, God puts an invisible cloak of love around you. And the first time that I heard that, I thought it was an absolute load of crap. But my experience tells me something very different. Very, very different. So with all this traveling that I was doing, that I was talking about, one of the things that I was not doing, I didn't have very much balance in my life. And I wore myself down. And in or Christmas holidays of this year, my wife and two kids, we were in Japan. We were visiting her family. And we all got sick. We all got bronchitis. The kids, the way that they are, you know, they got over it in a few days. And we were due to come home, and we said, well, what, do we go to hospital here in Japan, or we just fly the plane to go home? We said, let's just go. So we get on the plane and go home. A few days later, my wife started getting better, and I started getting worse. I started getting really bad. And I went to the hospital, and they said, you've got pneumonia. We need to put you in the hospital. So they put me in the hospital, and I continued to deteriorate, got worse and worse. And a couple days later, the nose cannula where they give you oxygen, I was maxing that out, and then they put a mask on my face, and I was maxing that out. And then they put a mask over my whole face, and I was maxing that out. Until a few days later, the doctors came in, and they said, well, you know, your pneumonia is getting really bad to the point that within a day or so, we're going to have to put you on a breathing machine and put you in an induced coma. And they said, well, we don't want to do that. We want to get ahead of the game. We don't do it right now. And the doctor said, do you have a medical health directive? And I said, well, my wife and I have talked about it. And he said, do you want to sign a DNR? And I knew I was in trouble then. And there was about six doctors in the room, and I said, can you give me 5 minutes? They walked out of the room, and I got down on my hands and my knees, and I said a third-step prayer like I have never said before, because I was literally turning my life over to the care of God as I understood it. And I felt this feeling of peace, like everything was going to be okay. And they came back in, and I said, okay, let me sign it, because I knew. I asked them, I said, okay, what's the prognosis? And he said, well, your pneumonia is very severe. You may not come out of it at all. You may come out of it and be fine, or you may come out of it and there could be brain damage depending upon how, you know, if we can get enough oxygen into you. So I said, okay. And I signed it and told my wife where all the life insurance policy was and access to the bank accounts and so forth, and away I went. Oh, no. One other thing that I did. I turned to my wife and I said, call Bob. Bob is a friend of ours in the program in Hawaii. And I said, please ask him and the people in the program to pray. And I was put in, they told me that, you know, intubated and on the breathing machine. They usually do that for 2 or 3 days. I was in an induced coma for 9 days. And it kept getting worse, and it got worse, and they were telling my wife, we just don't know what's going to happen. This was I went to the hospital on the 9th of January of this year. And I did see, I was in the tunnel, and I did see the light. And I can tell you, the only thing that I can tell you is what I felt was absolute unconditional love. But the other thing, I saw my wife's face. I saw her saying, please come back to us, we need you. And I heard people praying. A few days later, on the 15th of January, which is my sobriety day, I started to turn around. And the other thing about it is the doctors were never able to identify what the actual bug was. They ran more than 50 tests. They were never able to identify it. And the explanation, you know, what they do then is they basically hit you with a shotgun approach. They blast you full of every antibiotic known to man. And something happened on the 15th where I turned around. Either one of those antibiotics hit or my own immune system just kicked in and started. But I started to come back. And on the 9th day, I came. They brought me out of the coma. Then I went through. So it is... It is my belief that I am here now because of all of you. Because of that love, that cloak of love that I was talking about. Through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had people praying for me everywhere. Some of them are in this room right now. My family all over the world praying, and I heard all of that. And I really believe that I am here now because of them. So anyway, I came out of it, and I went through something called ICU psychosis. I was absolutely crazy after that, because your brain gets that way after being, you know, out of commission for a while. I thought I was my the King of England had come back and was trying to steal my body and bring it back to the Middle Ages. And all the doctors and nurses were trying to kill me, and so forth and so on. And I did not recognize my wife. I told her to get the hell out of here. It was really tough on her. But then something really interesting happened. My wife came, she was down in the cafeteria of the hospital. She says, I saw this guy, you know that guy Tony, the guy who's, you know, I've seen him in a couple of meetings. My wife's not in the program, but she's been, you know, she hangs around. She goes to meetings every once in a while. Tony, I saw him down there. I said, oh, bring him, you know. I was coming out of the hallucination stage at this point. And I said, bring him up here, yeah. So let me explain a little bit about Tony. Tony is a 72-year-old, bald, flamboyant, cross-dressing, Filipino-Hawaiian man. So Tony comes up, you know, Tony, it's good to see you. Neil, what's that? What's going on? Blah, blah, blah. I tell him the whole story. I said, I've been hallucinating and so forth and so on. And I thought she wasn't my wife. And Tony looked at me and he goes, Neil, you are hallucinating. She's not your wife. I'm your wife. And I laughed so hard, my wife laughed so hard, they just weaned me off of oxygen. I was laughing so hard, they almost had to put me back on oxygen again. But what he taught me was, he taught me how to wear life as a loose garment, just as the book talks about. And we talked, and a few days later, I asked Tony to be my sponsor. So he's my new sponsor in Hawaii. We have a very interesting relationship. Wow. It's almost 12 o'clock. This is an absolutely wonderful life. If I can say anything to any of you right now, if you are thinking about this program, whether this thing will work for you or not, what they told me in the beginning is do not leave before the miracle happens. I am proof here. You people gave me my sobriety. You gave me my life. I have a wonderful relationship with my higher power, and it's because of all of you. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I thought it was a place where you went just to stop drinking. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I met the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. Through the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys introduced me to the steps. And through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I found the power, which is our solution. And somewhere along the way, I met a stranger. The stranger was me. This is a wonderful program. Thank you very much for my life. Thank you for my sobriety. My name is Neil, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, Neil. Hey.